Welcome to the Battle Archive. Since 2005, the Academy of Ideas has organised the Battle of Ideas Festival, with debates on the key cultural, political, and scientific issues of the day. We are proud to be the home for unfettered debate, the People's Parliament, the place where new ideas come alive in open discussion. And now, we are opening our vault, making our recordings of public debate available to you, free to revisit and share as often as you like. For more free speech content and news on our next festival, subscribe below or head to academyofideas.org.uk. But for now, enjoy the discussion.
Okay, I don't know about you guys, but I can't believe we're already at the end of the first day. This is our final session in the battle for the economy strand. I know some of you have followed it through, others have dipped in and out, which is great. By the way, I'm Phil Mullen. This final session is focusing on the state, which is an issue that's arisen in a number of the previous economy sessions. We had one on taxation at lunchtime that Paul spoke at. And we've had a bit of a discussion around American industrial policy and could that be mimicked elsewhere. So I imagine that sort of issue will come up during the course. Now, of course, the question of whether the state should shape the development of economic activity is not a new one. It goes back at least to the 18th century. But I think one can say that over the past couple of years, the political momentum behind the need for government interventionism has become near universal. It's become legitimated again in response to the pandemic and the lockdown disruptions. And then I think the impulse in the context of Ukraine and energy crisis and so on, the impulse for achieving national self-sufficiency in a more dangerous and fragmented geopolitical world has added to that. So you have heightened national security concerns, you've got the decarbonization agenda, which will be discussed more in some sessions tomorrow, as well as the traditional goal of job creation are further motivations for the deployment of an interventionist state. I think one of the ironies about this new consensus, which has really built up over the last 3 years or so, I think one of the ironies is that that consensus seems to coexist with another consensus, which is that we've reached the exhausted limits of state intervention. There's a lot of discussion now about fiscal policy can't do anything anymore, monetary policy is in a bind. So there's a sense of exhaustion as well as coexisting with this interventionism. And so I think that dilemma highlights a core question, which we'll be talking about today, about the economic impact of the state, and to what extent are the domestic economic problems that we've been touching on in other sessions, can they be attributed to the state intervening too much, or too little, or in the wrong way? So to discuss all this, the actual potential economic role of the state, in the order of speaking, which happens to be the order they're sitting, which is great, we begin with Paul Embry, who's on my left here, who's a firefighter, trade unionist, columnist, broadcaster, and the author of Despised, Why the Modern Left Loathes the Working Class. You'll probably know, it's probably been said to you before, that the full biographies are all on the website, which you can look at your leisure later on. Second on my left is Matthew Lesh, who's the Director of Public Policy and Communications at the Free Market Institute of Economic Affairs. And then we have Ali Miraj on this side of me, a broadcaster, another broadcaster, also an infrastructure financier, founder of the well-known Contrarian Prize, and also a DJ, who you're not playing tonight.
Not tonight.
Not playing tonight. And finally, Hilary Salt, who you may have seen during the day. She is an actuary and is the founder of the pension consultancy called First Actuarial. Okay, so usual format, 5 to 6 minutes from them, and then over to you for clusters of questions. Thank you. First. Paul.
Thanks for that stretch.
You got it?
Yeah, can you hear me? It's no cooler in here, is it, than it was earlier? Bloody hell. Hi, everyone. Is there a role for the state in reviving economies? Absolutely there is, in my view. We've had 50 years, as we know, of neoliberalism, during which time We've been told that business chiefs and technocrats effectively know best, that government is no more than a necessary evil. And it's a philosophy that I think places undue faith in market outcomes. We saw it embodied, I guess, most starkly with Margaret Thatcher, the rolling back of the frontiers of the state, light-touch government, low taxes, low regulation, smashing up trade union rights, free movement of capital, flexible labour market, and so on, all in the interests of higher profits. And into the bargain, swathes of industry, British industry, were flogged off to the private sector. That's a philosophy that New Labour didn't really challenge when it came to power. There is no alternative, that famous slogan. New Labour saw no alternative. In fact, it probably put rocket boosters under that in some respects, you know, handing control of monetary policy to the Bank of England and so on to unaccountable officials, I should say, instead of elected representatives. Except the truth is that the market is not infallible, and that neoliberalism has not brought us the wealth and prosperity that was originally claimed for it. Instead, what we've seen is multiple financial crises. We've seen widening inequality. We've seen the decimation of our industrial base. We've seen housing crisis. We've seen the erosion of employment protections. And at the same time, the state is not merely a necessary evil. Yes, it can get things wrong, we know that, but the state can also, in economic terms and in other ways, be very much a force for good. When the global financial markets failed in 2008, and the markets couldn't correct what they'd caused, it was the state that had to step up. No other agency had the power or the incentive to step in and to put right what the markets had caused. When, you know, this is a lesson we learnt back in the 1930s, although we seem to have forgotten it since. When we're in recession and everybody else is tightening their belts, individual businesses and consumers are retrenching, only the state can lean against market logic. Only the state has got the power and the incentive to lean against market logic, to do what for many seems counterintuitive, and to keep spending, to keep investment levels and employment levels up in an attempt to turn the economy around. And as the market has come to dominate so much over the last half a century or so, and as the government has withdrawn from the arena economically and in other ways, the inevitable effect is that we've seen the concentration of wealth in fewer and fewer hands. That is, in many respects, the nature of the beast. We've seen a growing disparity in this country between rich and poor. And I think, for me, it's the job of elected governments and the job of the state to correct those imbalances. Whereas businesses will be focused, understandably, of course, in terms of focused on their narrow commercial interests as they would be, it's the state that has the power and the incentive to look at those wider economic interests, the economy as a whole, and to use all of the levers at its disposal, fiscal, monetary, industrial strategy, demand management, and so on, to redistribute more fairly and to take an overarching view of the economy in order to achieve growth and to establish the conditions to achieve growth and investment and job creation and so on. And ultimately, of course, to deliver on the promises, governments, elected governments, to deliver on the promises on which they were elected. And for me, that's a key point, and one that I think is very much wrapped up with this debate, because with the deepening of globalization, with the greater sort of interconnectedness, the emergence of the new global economy, the power of the multinationals and so on, the power of international capital generally, and the shrinking of the nation state, we have seen international capital and multinationals constantly bully elected governments effectively. So, you know, give us what we want, give us lower tax, give us less regulation, give us lower employment standards, give us lower environmental standards. If not, we're going to up and leave. That effectively is what's happening in terms of the power of international capital exercising that kind of influence over elected governments. And these elected governments are often petrified of the consequences of those threats if they're carried through. And too often we see them giving way, conceding ground to the multinationals and so on. And the danger there is, I think it tells people that no matter what you do at the ballot box, no matter who you choose as your representatives, they will play no role effectively in the running of the economy, and they're not very good at it even if they were to. You know, they should only play a very limited role, and we should leave everything, as I said at the beginning, to the technocrats and to the business chiefs who know best. And that, in the end, devalues the vote. That's the key point. It devalues the vote, and I think it has implications for democracy, massive implications. So to sum up, because I know I'm about to get a note saying 30 seconds or whatever, 1 minute. So to sum up, yes, to answer the question directly, yes, the state can be and often is a force for good in terms of reviving economies, can and should play a central role in reviving economies. Historically, there are examples where the state has done that. If you look at the Japanese post-war economic miracle, if you look at China now, in terms of the development and growth, the state very much plays, and I don't believe, by the way, in an all-powerful state, but nonetheless a state that plays a central role in managing the economy, because without that, in terms of revival of our economy, which I think we all want, it would take a damn sight longer.
Thanks, Paul. Matthew.
Well, there we have it. We're living in a neoliberal utopia, everyone. I hope you're enjoying your historically low taxes, the fact that the confines of the state have withdrawn. I hope you're really happy about how much regulation the government has been cutting in recent history. I have to say, I feel like as someone from often called neoliberal think tank, we've won. Now, of course, unfortunately, Paul, we know pretty much none of that is true, and I would say, sadly, none of that is true. So I'm going to try to make three quick points in my opening remarks. The first one is to build on this idea that the state has not withdrawn in any particularly meaningful way. There was a slight retrenchment, you could say, when the state sold a small set of previously publicly owned industries, I would say, for the best. It then chose to regulate them to the extreme, and that is really an essential part of the problems we face. Secondly, I'm going to talk about how when larger state will slow down, and is, in fact, inevitably slowing down our economy, and then I'm going to talk about how I think overregulation is what's holding us back, and we need to really rethink the role of the state rather than just keep on thinking that it can keep going on its merry way. So on this first point, I think the state is fundamentally broken. And I suspect Paul and I would agree with this to some extent, but I don't think it's because it's not big enough or it doesn't have enough resources. We know that the tax take is the highest in the post-war era. The state is choosing to take more of our incomes than previously. It's spent, obviously, then borrowing on top of that and then spending even more. The state has been introducing more and more regulation, even under a Conservative government. If you go through the UK legislation website, you will see more and more regulation every single day that is intruding on the capacity of economic actors. You have a government that's talked about things like industrial policy again and again, has bought up assets like OneWeb, a satellite company. I don't know why the government needs to run a satellite company, but there you are. So I think when you then think about that on one end, and then you think about what are we getting for all that bigger state? We're getting pretty poor quality public services. The NHS, for example, has more money than ever before, and yet patient outcomes are worse and worse. So I'm not sure the solution to any of our problems is let's just make the state bigger and more powerful, and rather than stepping back and thinking, what do we actually want the state to achieve? What is it best at? What can it do that nobody else can do? And then say, let's deliver those services as functionally as possible, rather than trying to do too many things, rather than having this expectation that the state can be the saviour of our economy and our lives and make everything good and nice in the universe, and that technocrats that and bureaucrats can function there. So, in terms of the role of state, I think it is, in fact, gotten too big, and we need to, I suppose, get it back to its core functions, and it needs to do those core functions better rather than trying to do more and more. The second point I'm going to try and make here is just about how, as you expand the state, it does slow down the economy. I mean, quite fundamentally, the reason why we have quite extraordinary levels of inflation in the last 2 years is because the state massively, and to some extent justifiably, but not entirely, spent a lot of money during COVID. The central bank printed a lot of cash or bought up that government debt, and that's what's driven inflation. It's driven down our quality of life. The state has had a massive negative impact on us as a result. But I think you can think about that in the direct inflationary sense, but I think we can also start thinking about this in terms of what happens when the state tries to intervene more in business, when it goes beyond that core function about public services and safety, it doesn't tend to do that well. You know, there is a very poor record of the state picking certain companies based upon political factors, based upon who is an effective lobbyist, who can do the best rent-seeking in order to be able to get state funds. There's study after study, whenever the government goes back and tries to assess the kind of industrial policies that it's doing, it's usually there's... If they are even assessed, which is quite rare when the government gives out money to random businesses, it's usually found to have had no particularly positive impact. There was one particular study of the government's biggest subsidy regime for small business that effectively it tried to compare companies that did and did not receive the government money, more or less found that the companies that didn't receive government money did just as well. What happens, though, when you do have this whole framework set around trying to seek out state support or even regulatory, both money and regulatory support, is you create something called subsidy entrepreneurs. Rather than people doing something productive to grow the economy and serve other people, which is what the profit motive is, it encourages you to create a product that other people want to buy, people put their effort into trying to lobby government for support. So the more the state gets, the bigger you have that kind of low-level corruption going on and again and again. And I think it's interesting, you know, if you think about a case like China, which Paul just mentioned, we can see right now, as the Chinese state is re-intruding more and more the economy, they are facing an economic crisis they don't quite know how to get out of. There was a short period where they did manage immense amount of growth thanks to the, you know, ingenuity and entrepreneurialism of the Chinese people being let free from the shackles of the CCP for a very relatively short period of time and created immense wealth. But today we're seeing the complete opposite. And I think we can learn from that, that if we want to be successful, we don't want to be more like China. I think we want to be a lot less like China and worry about thinking about that. Now, the final point I want to make here is what can we do to get growth? What are the problems that we're facing here? And I would say probably the biggest problem we're facing, I mean, taxes are too high, and I know you'll hear people like me talk about that all the time, but I think that's almost a secondary issue compared to the regulation that imposes far bigger costs on society and where the state has very much limited businesses' ability to create wealth, to people, to entrepreneurs to start things up, has probably led to too much consolidation of wealth, although if you actually look at the stats, inequality has not increased meaningfully in the last 20 or 30 years, according to the Gini coefficient. But putting that aside, the UK is, and I know this discussion's already happened, it's poorer than it should be, it's 39% poorer than the US. There are simple things we can do, that the state can do, to get out of the way to enable us to be richer. And I would say the number one thing is to address the failures of our planning system. We're not building enough homes, we're not building homes where people want to live, where means that people can't be as productive as they would otherwise be. We're not building the necessary energy infrastructure that we need in order to power the economy, so our costs of business are much higher. We're not putting enough lab space around Cambridge, so that there's a big shortage of even some of the most innovative companies in order to be able to keep themselves in the UK. So you see, just in that one example, how taking away or reducing the role of the state and a state-imposed barrier could make us a lot richer. Thank you.
Just reflecting on what Paul and Matthew said, it reposes my irony in a slightly different way, is that given the ideology for so long, from the 80s through to, you can say, some people say the financial crash, some say through to the pandemic, was so anti-state and pro-market, why is it that the state has seemingly extended its tentacles so much? When the ideology is one thing and the reality is different, worth playing around with to try and work that out. Ali.
Thank you very much, Phil, and thank you for the Battle of Ideas for putting on another fantastic set of debates today. It's always a pleasure to be here. Now, we have a serious problem in this country, which is one of low productivity and ultimate stagnation. I mean, if you look back at the last 15 years, we have not improved our productivity at all. I mean, we're flatlining completely. We have inequality growing. We have wages that have not increased. That's why you see strike action writ large across the public sector, which has been going on for the best part of well over a year now. Now, if you look at where we are compared to other countries, let me just give you a couple of stats here. Productivity growth in the 12 years following the financial crisis 07-08 was 0.4%. This was the lowest out of the 25 richest countries in the world. If you take the average income of the average household of this country, it is 16% lower than Germany and 9% lower than France. So this is not necessarily a rich country malaise. It's a uniquely British problem. Now, the stats abound here. I mean, you've got all sorts of issues. Partly this is because there has been a lack of real strategic thinking on the part of successive governments. And when it comes to the role of the state, there are three sort of phases that occurred here. One was the post-World War II era, where there was a role for the state. You had the setting up of the NHS. You had a lot more intervention. You get to the 70s, late 70s, where the whole economy was basically not working. You had Thatcher and Reagan with their prescription coming through, and you had a lot more rolling back of the state and a lot more flourishing of the private sector. And now where we are in the post 2007-08 financial crisis era, where again you've seen that the state has been a bit nervous about getting involved until the pandemic, where it really changed the complete landscape of the game. It's only the state that can invest $400 billion in propping up people in their jobs and investing to try and deal with a once-in-a-100-year event like COVID. So the state can be a benign force for good, but I think we need to think about three things if we are actually going to use the state in the right way to actually improve our economy. And those three things are as follows. The first is long-term thinking. The problem with the democratic system that we have here, unlike China, and I'm not advocating autocracy as a model, by the way, but in autocracies, you can get things done quite quickly at great expense, you might say, to civil liberties and human rights and other things, but you can. You can build super high-speed rail very, very fast, where you don't have to deal with multiple planning applications being stopped in the High Court by people in Chesham and Amersham, for example, right? So they're not just in Chesham and Amersham, by the way. They are around the country. But you need long-term thinking. We can't think beyond, I was going to say 4 to 5 years, but Liz Truss, Matthew works for her favorite think tank, couldn't think beyond 49 days. I mean, call it a summer internship as prime minister, you know, whatever. I mean, so we have a serious problem. The current government can't think beyond the end of next week in terms of, you know, who's going to resign or who's going to be involved in some sexual scandal. So we have a serious democratic problem in this country about thinking long term. That's why you have things like the National Infrastructure Commission that forces this long term thinking, but it has no statutory teeth whatsoever. It can only recommend. It cannot do anything more than that. So I think we need to try and think about how we move to a much more cross-party basis for thinking longer term about the needs of this country strategically in terms of a future for economic growth and the infrastructure that we need. And you just think about, so long-term thinking is number one. Number two is infrastructure. If you think about the role of the state in infrastructure, I just give you two simple examples. One is the Chinese state. The Belt and Road, it's using infrastructure as a tool of foreign policy. It's spent billions on moving its tentacles around the whole place, from Africa, even into Europe, across the whole sweep, the New Silk Road. They also are absolutely clear-headed about Made in China 2025. They're going to become a lot more self-sufficient. They're not going to be relying on international supply chains to the extent that we are relying on them. So that's why they're investing in strategic areas like AI, semiconductors, electric vehicle charging, all of these things. We need to be thinking along the same lines, because we cannot rely on these intertwined supply chains that you saw in the pandemic were put under severe pressure, which is why people are talking about friendshoring. The other example that I wanted to give of long-term infrastructure investment now is Joe Biden's Inflation Reduction Act, $385 billion from Sleepy Joe. I mean, a guy can barely get off a plane, but actually, he's got his bill through the House, and you've got to give him credit for that, because he's called it the Inflation Reduction Act. It's got nothing to do with inflation reduction at all. So you've got to give the guy some credit, $385 billion. On top of the $1.2 trillion Infrastructure, Industry, and Jobs Act, which is the biggest investment in infrastructure in the U.S. since Dwight Eisenhower's Interstate Highway Program in 1956. Real vision. That's going to determine EV charging, battery storage, hydrogen, all of these things going forward. So that's the second thing. So the government can have a really, really big impact on big infrastructure projects. And the other thing that I wanted to say is the final thing in this trilogy, if you like, or trio of things that need to be done, is agency. We need to be giving more agency to local areas. You see the Angel of the North. I talk, of course, of Andy Burnham up in Manchester, who's very upset about the fact that Rishi Sunak, of all places, chose to go to Manchester to announce the fact that he would cancel HS2. I mean, I don't know what kind of PR advisors he has. But quite honestly, I mean, you'd have to be a rocket scientist to work out that that would not go down very well. But you've even got Andy Street in Birmingham, who's also championing his cause. So these people actually matter. They have become figures in their own right on the map. They champion the cause of their areas. Up in Teesside, you've got Ben Houchin, who I think is sort of extending that a little bit beyond where he needs to be. But they have agency. So you need these three elements: long-term thinking, massive investment in infrastructure, innovation and skills, and agency, devolving more power to regions so that they feel they have a stake and the decision-making on critical needs is made closer to where the electors are. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And finally, Hillary.
Thank you. So the way I thought I might tackle this is by looking at some of the things that government does that I don't think it should do, and some of the things that government doesn't do, but I think it should. So I will focus on economics, but just to get you into the swing of it, in the kind of does but shouldn't column, I put things like schools teaching mindfulness, or even cleaning children's teeth if Labour get their way. And in the doesn't do but should column, I'd put things like running prisons and training the Royal Navy. It's just given a tender to a private sector company to train the Royal Navy recently. So I can list loads of those things, but I'm going to just stick to the top three in the economics area. So on the things that government does but it shouldn't do. So first of all, we talked about this quite a bit today in this room. It demands a raft of unnecessary layers of compliance that overburden public services and in the private sector stifle competition and always favour the big established businesses over challengers. Now, it's really easy to criticise the army of professionals that are employed by our public services on diversity, equity and inclusion roles, and we've done a fair bit of that today. But the pressure to do that comes from the public sector equality duty that was imposed by Section 149 of the Equality Act 2010. So it's a government thing that forces these kind of things to happen. And similarly, in the private sector, Section 172 of the Companies Act 2006, I'll be testing you on all this later, by the way, and the Corporate Governance Code, they both require UK businesses to undertake a raft of actions on things like business culture, independence, environmental impacts, lots of things that have really nothing to do with the core purposes of those businesses. And to comply with those requirements, companies almost inevitably have to employ a layer of bureaucracy and risk management that doesn't just drive out profits, but it also stifles innovation in the business. Secondly, it passes decision-making and policy choices to experts. The economic equivalent of the follow the science mantra we saw in the COVID response is the power and influence given to the Office for Budgetary Responsibility. That supposedly independent body has a role in scrutinising public finances in the fiscal risks and sustainability report. And both our political parties are absolutely committed and wedded to, I think they call them something different there, but kind of charters for public responsibility that effectively say they will continue to give those unelected civil servants the power to kick the tyres on the sustainability of any financial commitments by future governments. Thirdly, they continue to prop up big, unprofitable, what we've called before, zombie companies. Government spends around £300 billion a year on outsourcing. Over 20% of that is spent with their big strategic suppliers, you know, services ranging from kind of scanning to big infrastructure projects. But a lot of that is effectively corporate welfare. Those businesses would not exist without the public purse. And they're often inefficient, often very highly geared businesses that you know really aren't doing the economy any favour. Shouldn't be held up by government. So what about the other side of the coin? What's government not doing that it should do? So first of all, government should control fiscal and monetary policy, as Paul has said. It's not right that the unelected Bank of England controls interest rates and has used that control to preside over decades of cheap money, which has made it easy to stuff our companies full of debt, transforming both the ownership of those companies and where risk lies in society. But then it was also the bank who, when interest rates couldn't go any lower, chose to subject us to the untested experiment of quantitative easing, QE. In three main tranches in 2009, 2016, 2020, they spent nearly £900 billion on QE. That's 5 years' worth of NHS funding. And then in a rather breathtaking example of marking their own homework, something that they as a regulator say that people shouldn't do, it drew the rather underwhelming conclusion that, quote, on balance, the evidence suggests that QE supports the objective of monetary policy, namely price stability. Well, great, they spent £900 billion on something that might just work. And of course, QE has had some massive other impacts, causing a market asset bubble, continuing market nervousness around the impact of QT, quantitative tightening, as the bank's asset purchases will need to be unwound. Secondly, it should have an industrial strategy, a plan to revitalise the economy across the UK and invest in research and development, including research in blue sky areas where it's not clear where the new technology might be applied. And thirdly, it should recognise its responsibility to ensure we have adequate and functioning infrastructure. I do think there are things the private sector are good at. I'd gladly leave the railway station hotels, which were the first thing Thatcher privatised, in private sector hands. But we need cheap, reliable power, well-maintained sewage, drainage, and appropriate investment in schools, hospitals, roads and railways. And that will take significant investment by the state. So finally, why is that positive role for the state not happening? And I think the problem at the moment is the aspirations of the state, because the two main parties are only wedded to stability, where we want them to want transformation. As people have said, UK productivity has lagged behind for 40 years, and stability in this position of just about managing isn't good enough. Government could play a great role in that transformation by that massive infrastructure investment, by forcing companies to invest in training and development, by forging partnerships with industry and our universities to drive forward research and innovations, and by enacting a new economic strategy. And of course, if government did that, it would be opposed by a wall of opposition from the OBR, the green lobby, the planning system, the experts, the markets, the established big business, the blob. But we need to make sure that our political leaders build up the courage to stand up to that challenge so government can be a help and not a hindrance.
Great, thank you all very much. And over to you for the first batch. In the middle here, we've got how many microphones? We've got two.
Lovely, thank you. Yes, thank you for some really interesting, diverse views there. Firstly, can I just sort of say, Ali, I think the problem with Liz Truss was she was looking ahead. That's why they destroyed her. That's what politics is about at the moment, short-termism. She was for long-termism, and that's a tragedy for all of us, I would suggest. But what I wanted to come to is the state getting, does it need to get bigger? It is. That's what net zero is all about. Net zero is the way the whole industrial system is taken under control and transformed and controlled. And don't believe a word of what Rishi Sunak and the Conservative government are saying about pulling it back. The fines are still in place for boiler manufacturers, for the car industry. We're living in a cloud cuckoo Truman show land where actually what's going on is right in front of us, but we can't see it because we're being conned. So what I'd say, Paul, is you've got your big state. It's guaranteed. It's in the Climate Change Act, and it's going to carry on. So my question is, do we agree with that? Do we think that's a good thing? Or do we think we should be publicly addressing that and have a proper debate?
Great. Thank you. Just to make the obvious point, that we've got a whole series tomorrow, a whole strand on green policies, including net zero. But that's not to stop people commenting on it here, but just to bear that in mind. Frontier.
Yeah, Stephen Wilson from the Institute of Public Affairs in Australia. Ali, you said there's a productivity crisis in this country. It's not only here, it's also in Australia. My question, and then you emphasised about infrastructure. On the point with net zero, my question to you is the allocation or misallocation of capital to unproductive things undermining capital productivity, not just labour productivity? And my question to Matthew is, in a very sort of private sector mindset, when people are applying the discounted cash flow method and using NPV as a decision tool, How do you get decisions in long-term assets beyond 15, 20 or so years?
Okay. Yep. I've got two questions, really. One is, sorry, I forgot your name.
Ali.
Yeah, I completely agree with the fact that a lot of the things that we need to look at in this country in terms of infrastructure has a 5, 10, 15, 20-year horizon. I'd be interested to know how we decouple those decisions from politics. I mean, just how do we do that? And the second point is it really, looking at the state of both parties and the economy, is it that we're bumbling along and things just aren't bad enough that we need a real FDR or, God forgive, you know, Thatcher or what, someone who's going to say, we just can't carry on like this. We have to have a strong long-term leadership and a different direction. It seems to me that Britain is just bumbling along, putting up with a lot of things that don't work, but it's not so bad that we just have to change.
Okay, just add to your question about decoupling decisions on infrastructure from politics. I'd also add to that question, is that the right way to go? Is not one of the problems the decoupling which already exists? So it's worth thinking about how politics could play a different role. William here.
Thanks. I just wanted to help the room and the panel with this conundrum, this paradox as to why state spending goes up. And Matthew's not happy with that. But it goes up partly as a result of a sort of neoliberal Thatcherite policies. I mean, a lot of the reason that we've had to put state spending up is, to use a metaphor, it's sort of mopping up the blood of deindustrialization. It's gutting factories and creating poverty in the Midlands and the North is astonishingly expensive. I think Thatcherism was totally self-defeating in its social consequences, but economically it's disastrous. It's a complete myth that Thatcher decreased the size of the state. She didn't. And one of the reasons that we don't have a strong and active state doing the things we want, like investment in housing or trams in Leeds, is a lot of that's caused by literally welfare, necessary welfare payments to mop up the blood of the failure.
Okay, I'll take one more and then back to the panel. So this gentleman here.
Yeah, there seems an interesting bit of common ground between Matthew and Paul in the fact they both don't like technocrats. Yeah, you both criticise technocrats, and we mentioned the Bank of England as well. So I suppose my question is, how do we stop these unelected representatives from controlling so much of the economy? Where do we begin? I'd be interested in both of your strategies to address that.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much. Well,
I mean, on that last point, I would like to see government restore democratic control over the Bank of England. Simple as that. I'm not saying that would be a panacea, but it strikes me that it's a way for governments to shirk blame. It's a way for governments to say, look, it's not really down to us. Look, the reason interest rates are going up at the moment, the reason you're really feeling it in your pockets, you're struggling to pay your mortgages, businesses are going under, these interest rates, it's not really us, it's those people at the Bank of England. And, you know, if you ask us about it and whether we think they're right or wrong, we're not really going to tell you. And for me, that just drives a coach and horses through the democratic principle that actually a main task of any government is to manage the economy in the interests of the people, and actually giving off planks of economic responsibility to unaccountable officials and then standing from under and saying there's nothing we can do about it completely undermines democracy. I was struck by with the Liz Truss episode, sorry to intrude on private grief, Matthew, but with the Liz Truss episode and the fallout from that, and the turmoil that was going on at the time, and the tumult in the markets and the city. I remember Keir Starmer being interviewed on, I think it was a Radio 4 Today programme. Now, given what this was doing to the economy, and given the impact for ordinary people in terms of their pensions, their pay packets, interest rates and so on, the interviewer said to him, what do you think the Bank of England should do at the moment? And he gave absolutely no answer, apart from saying, well, the Bank of England's independent, I'm not going to intrude on their territory, essentially. And you think, hold on a second, here's the leader of His Majesty's opposition at a time of economic national crisis, and he's been asked, what should the Bank of England do? And he's effectively said, don't ask me, Governor. That's for those people whose names we don't know, who we wouldn't recognise if they were sitting here now. It's nothing to do with us as elected politicians. That's for those people to do. If I can just quickly answer the question about the original question about the big state. Look, I agree with Hillary. There are some things I do not want the state to do. If I'm going out for a meal, I don't want the state to cook it. If I'm buying a suit, I don't want the state to make it. There are some things that the private sector does very, very well, and I believe in a flourishing private sector. But there are some things I want the state to do. I don't particularly want the private sector to provide the energy that comes into my home. I don't particularly want to sit through an energy brochure and see what's the best choice for me. I want the water system publicly owned. I would like to see the railway system publicly owned. It seems to me, in terms of a big state, that actually we have privatised so much of what we used to do. And even if you look at local government now, the things that local, I said in the earlier meeting, actually, I grew up on a council estate in Dagenham in East London. The local authority was very much a feature, a part of people's everyday lives. You might think that's a bad thing, but they used to mow people's gardens if they were vulnerable. They used to decorate people's houses, used to fix people's houses and whatever. There was a council yard every few blocks with workmen working there the whole time. All of that has gone. And the council services have been outsourced to private enterprise. So in terms of the big state, it just strikes me that actually there's a lot less that we do now as a country publicly than we used to do. Sorry, I went on a bit too long.
Thanks, Paul. Matthew. Well, there's a lot to go on there, but I think I want to make a central overall point that I think responds to some of what's been said on the panel in the audience, which is this idea of if only we could have our improve the quality of our politics and get politicians thinking long term. It's like think in what world that is actually possible or achievable goal. Like, think about the person you want to be making these decisions. I think this goes for everything here we're trying to talk about here. It's like, maybe the Bank of England shouldn't be independent, but do you really want Rishi Sunak setting interest rates? Maybe you do, but or Keir Starmer or your Jeremy Corbyn setting interest rates, do you think that would lead to better policy? Do you think they would have made better decisions? The same goes with, do we think a government-run telecommunications network in the style that it was before it was privatised, where you had to call up and it took you a month to get a phone line installed. Do we think that was a better system? Do we think that like these technocrats that Paul's having go out will suddenly become competent if they have more responsibility? And I think we have to be very careful here in thinking that the state has this like magical, the state isn't just a series of people that are flawed like anybody else making difficult decisions, and they're trying to do it in too many ways with too little information and with an incapacity and inability, and inevitably driven by not just what is the public good, but factually inevitably driven by politics. You cannot remove politics from the state. You can't make the state automatically good at making its decisions in an impartial way, no matter how much we idealise that concept of like, oh, can't we just be like China? Well, I don't know if we really do want to be like China in the first place. And it's not like the Chinese government is making particularly good decisions. They're spending a lot of people's money in a lot of terrible ways and added authoritarianism when you go to the extreme there. I think there's another point I want to make here, which is the sense in which the market system, it's like, okay, so who makes the decision here is coming up. But what I think is misread here is that the market system is fundamentally a democratic system. It's fundamentally a democratic system because the decisions about how we allocate resources in the economy are made through the decisions that we make in this room by what we choose to buy. When you go to the bakery to buy your croissant, that sends a signal throughout the market system that what we need to do is produce enough flour, that it's worth a baker getting up at 4 a.m. in the morning to ensure that that product is delivered to you. It is you who is making the allocated decision, and it's through those millions of decisions we make every single day in our lives that we direct the economy. So that is effectively the market system. That is a voluntary system. The alternative to that is the technocratic state-led system in which some central power is making decisions on our behalf. Now, in some cases, that may very well be necessary and justified, but that is a system of force and is a system that's more often than not delivered quite poor outcomes. So in that sense, you've got to think about the state rather than this idea of a state that doesn't exist and can't exist, which is this perfectly all-knowing, all-seeing, all-capable eye.
Yeah, so just on Liz Truss, look, given where we are, I think that this decision to cut the top rate of tax with 400 billion of borrowing on the back of COVID and 2.5 trillion public debt was the most ridiculous, reckless act she could have ever done. And in fact, the very financial markets that she and Kwasi Kwarteng both worship gave their verdict quite clearly on what they thought of that, which is utterly incredible and disgraceful, frankly. And you've got to be able to take people with you. The problem Liz Truss had is she wasn't thinking long-term at all. She was thinking about, okay, I've got one chance here. Let me just slash and burn and let's see what happens. You've got to have a strategic vision and take people with you along that journey. You can't just do what she did and be completely reckless. Now, in terms of infrastructure capital allocation that was mentioned here, it's an interesting question. I don't think that the government should necessarily be, well, it has to invest in large infrastructure projects like HS2, for example, because no one else will do it. The private sector is not going to do that on its own because no infrastructure investor is going to take that level of complicated risk. It's just too big and too difficult to do. But you will have things like the Thames Tideway Tunnel that is being financed by private capital with some backing from the government, and you will also have, in my view, the government, what they should be doing is trying to crowd in private capital for the rollout of electric vehicle charging, hydrogen, battery storage, carbon capture and storage, by providing some sort of level of subsidy, at least in the early years, whilst this is all very nascent technology, before it becomes commonplace, just like they did with onshore and offshore wind, right? There were subsidies. Now those subsidies have been pulled back because the private sector is all over it and it's been normalized. So I think you do need that if you're going to crowd in at scale. If you want to tinker around with a couple of EV charging points around Westminster, fine. But we're not going to move at scale unless we do that. So I think that's what needs to be done. How do we decouple infrastructure from short-term political decision-making? Very, very flipping difficult, frankly. I mean, you do have a natural infrastructure commission that has been run by Sir John Armitt, who's a very sensible guy. He's got very good commissioners on there. But they don't have any teeth. So, I mean, you could come and say, look, we'll have a cross-party consensus on this, that the NIC come up with a list of projects that are investable, that are needed, and then there'll be a cross-party committee that will discuss these and choose which ones it wants to back. And maybe that's the way to do it. I don't know. It was still difficult to implement. But look, I think the other thing that we need to do is government needs to put some pressure also on pension funds in this country, because when we talk about infrastructure, some of the biggest investors in this country are Aussie and Canadian pension funds, not our own pension funds here. Why? Because they're all absolutely terrified of taking any sort of risk at all. And that's why you have all these big overseas investors investing in our infrastructure, which is perfectly fine for them because they get good returns for their shareholders. We don't have inadequate risk-taking in this country on the part of our own pension funds. That's something the government could resolve and put pressure on those pension funds.
Thanks. Hillary.
Briefly on pension funds, because I could talk about them all day, but a lot of that avoidance of risk is really very much down to government and government's regulatory system as it's applied through the pensions regulator, who forced schemes to move out of equities and into bonds. Yeah. So I don't think it's necessarily schemes' fault. I do think you have to point the finger at government as well. Just on, there's two things that just worry me a little bit about what you're saying, Alan. One is this idea of a kind of cross-party consensus, because, again, in the field of pensions, people often make this point that pensions shouldn't be a political football. Now, I think pensions is one of the most political things there is. It's about wealth transfer. It's about intergenerational transfers of wealth. It's about redistribution. It's about investment. It's about employment. And to say that shouldn't be political is absolutely wrong. What that means is we need the two parties to go and stitch up something and then they'll impose it on us. Now, I think, you know, the only way we actually start to change things is by having a social consensus. If you look back to the welfare state wasn't two parties going stitching something up and imposing it on the population. It was a public discussion and debate and consensus that said things can't carry on the way they are. And I do think that's where we need to get to today, which kind of answers the question, how bad does it have to get? So, you know, if you look at something like our water system, we've got 200,000 miles of water pipes that are built in Victorian times. How, you know, one way to destroy those would be war. Now, I'm not suggesting that's a good idea. But, you know, I think we do need to find some ways of saying, you know, how do we drag out all that unproductive stuff and put in stuff that's good and that's fit for purpose. And I think that does take a kind of a popular forcing of the politicians to do it. I just don't think it will come top down. We've got to start driving this by telling people it's not good enough.
Great. Okay, we've got a cluster here. Where's the microphone? Where's it gone? Come on. Yes, this woman here, and then next to you, and then there.
Thank you.
Stand up. Thanks.
First of all, I'd just like to pick up on something that Ali said, just speaking on behalf of the Liz Truss Fan Club. Her abolishing the higher rate of tax was such a small part of the overall budget that it actually had a minimal impact. What actually did for Liz Truss, as we know, was the high interest rates, and that was caused by the Bank of England selling LDIs, thank you, Hillary, nodding, without the Treasury's knowledge, or certainly without hers or Kwasi's knowledge. So if we could just put that lie to bed, it was absolutely terrible what happened and a travesty. But my actual question to the committee is, is the British economy more sluggish because we have actually successfully imported loads of globalised businesses? So, as Matthew says, we've lost the connection between business and democracy, because if a few of us decide not to go to several coffee shops, it makes no difference. And what worries me is that we need to go back to an economy. We need to go back to being sort of a nation of shopkeepers and more independently owned businesses that have to function properly and are not just landowners.
Thank you. Next to you. No, you're first. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. I want to argue against the idea that I don't think an idea that I don't think is necessarily kind of overtly expressed by the panel, which is arguing against the idea that this is in any way a kind of clear-cut or moral debate. I think this is an entirely kind of pragmatic debate. The idea that we provide goods and services that enable people and businesses to get on in life is obviously going to be require more state intervention in some instances and less state intervention in other instances. And I've kind of come to this discussion because it's not a subject I find easy to get worked up about, and I think I kind of still don't. So and I think it's kind of very easy that we say there are definitely some things the state should or shouldn't do, and to rationalise quite easily for ourselves what we think is a kind of moral or defendable thing. I think that outsourcing is a really great example of that, where on the one hand, yes, the state might create an economy that's been described as a zombie economy of lots of different businesses doing lots of things that probably should just be a much more effective and cheaper to run function of the state. But then at the same time, if the state were to take on those responsibilities and to deliver them directly, we'd worry about the amount of our economy we're operating through state budget sheets, which is why those things were outsourced often in the first place. Like, I think the kind of fundamental question that we're dealing with, and we started to get at it with like discussions about infrastructure or discussions about the kind of long term, is effectively about like, what are the signals we think a state needs to send in order to make an economy function. And Matthew, I think it's very easy that like you've picked up on regulation as a thing that the state does to stop businesses operating in certain ways. But there's also lots of political signals like that can create certainty that our political class just aren't making. The idea that we were going to spend 5 years talking about whether HS2 would or wouldn't happen itself has a detrimental force in our economy.
Thank you.
There's much more at stake here.
Okay, in front of you. Thanks.
Okay, well, I come from a country in which there's been quite a long, seemingly joint effort to destroy a relatively robust economy. The state is, of course, Germany. So we have now low productivity rates. You mentioned Germany quite positively, but at the moment things do look quite gloomy. And the point I wanted to make is that when I say that there's been a joint effort, I have the feeling it's been a joint effort of the state, of politics, but also in combination with companies. It would be very, very hard to make a distinction here. So a lot of the mistakes which were made in the past, a disastrous energy politics, quantitative easing, and so on, was completely supported by businesses. So you mentioned, Paul, the multinational companies, but I'm thinking of companies which are quite well rooted within Germany, companies like Siemens, which have really benefited from their cooperation, close cooperation with the state. And now that we've come into this sort of mess, what they're all doing is they're blaming the electorate, saying, oh, we did this all, we changed our energy policy because of the electorate, which is blatantly untrue. And I think the only thing both of these areas, both the state and the economy, which is very, very strongly interwoven, would agree on is that we shouldn't have, that the electorate or the government shouldn't define interest rates, the point you make. So it's basically a joint action, I would say, the state and private companies against the electorate. And I think that's really what we're seeing at the moment. So, why would anybody say that interest rates shouldn't be defined by our governments? But industry is saying that, and the state is saying that, and there's something very wrong.
Can you pass it to your right? Thank you.
Hello. There have been some attacks on Bank of England independence. Could I be bold enough to try to defend the current system of Bank of England independence?
Sure.
This is a complicated question. I've got 4 points to make. First of all, if we remember the 1970s and the 1980s, there was a massive inflation problem and we didn't know what to do about. It's arguable that Bank of England independence has largely solved the inflation problem. Secondly, inflation has increased in the last 2 years. I'd say that's largely a supply shock, which is difficult for any institutional framework to cope with. My expectation would be that in the next couple of years, inflation will go back and return to target. Anyway, let's talk about this in the Battle of Ideas 2025. But I think it would be dangerous to try to change the cut system now until we've seen whether the policy in combating the massive supply shocks we've had over the recent years has worked. Thirdly, I'd like to make a distinction between criticising the institutional framework and criticising the specific decisions that have been made by the Bank of England. One could criticise the decisions made by the Bank of England. They should have anticipated the rise in inflation earlier than they did and taken action. But criticising the specific actions taken by the Bank of England is not the same as criticising the overall institutional framework. And fourthly, it's said that the Bank of England isn't accountable. Well, I'm sorry, it is accountable. It has a 2% inflation target, and it's obliged, the Bank of England governor is obliged to account to the Chancellor of the Exchequer for that. That's what I have.
Thank you very much. Behind you to Nico.
Nico McDonald. Just wanted to pick up on one question you asked, Phil, about why we had deregulated the state and yet the state seemed to be more regulated than ever. And Paul might sympathise or at least agree with my answer. I wonder how much it's to do with the fact it was deregulation, a bit like, corporate welfare. Deregulation for them, but not for us. So they deregulated the financial and the industrial sector and they said to workers, essentially, you're deregulated now, often outsource them. Paul talks about in the context of local councils and so on. So they had less strong rights, didn't have collective bargaining in the same way they had in the past. So it was like, it was a kind of mirage that the only people who got deregulated were really the working class, and essentially they lost their collective bargaining and industrial rights and so on. So I wonder if that explains to some extent why, that contradiction. Just briefly, I think Ali mentioned the idea that in China it's easier to build infrastructure because you don't have democracy, which is probably true in other places that were undemocratic as well. At a recent conference I gave, a lecturer pointed out the new road, Euston Road, as it is now. When that was built in the early 19th century, they still had to negotiate with property owners to build that road. It was an age of mass democracy, probably, maybe a fifth of the population or a tenth were enfranchised. So I don't think we should imagine that, it's always been the case that, we were able to build infrastructure in the 19th century despite having, a civil society and democracy. And finally, I just wanted to pick up on the question of the state, which maybe comes back to what Paul was talking about. We talk about re-enabling the state and its new role, but the state in the last 30, 40 years has been denuded of competence. It's been, we talked about outsourcing to ALBs, you know, companies like PwC and so on. The state's capability to do anything has been severely eroded. So if we are going to re-empower the state to take action and so on, this is something Lee Jones argued in the Telegraph at the start of the pandemic. He's an academic at Queen Mary. We've got to rebuild the competence of the state, and that is no small project to do. So we can't just imagine we can re-enable the state and suddenly it will have capability.
Okay, can I see who else wants to speak? Okay, I'll take one more now, get the platform, and then I'll take you five later. At the front here, please put your hand up, and then you. Sorry, I'll take you two before the panel. Yeah.
Hi there, my name's Mike. I might be the only one here, I don't know, that actually works in the state. And I've been, right?
No, you won't. No, the only one.
Not the only one, but some of the things I've heard of my local government the last 20 years, and it. None of you have talked about the organisations of how they operate, how decisions are made, who's there, the culture, etc. And without knowing that, you're not even at first base. And the second thing is that unless you've actually worked there, you cannot know. You cannot know. It's not in books. It's not in media. You're guessing. And I've heard a couple of things, and, you know, we're all friends here, but some of the things I've heard here are just, like, out there, you know.
Like, to be, you know? Like what?
Okay, no markets. The public sector internally is markets. And you say, well, stop that. How? That's how humans interact. So to say we've got to get away from markets, the internal is a market. It is voluntary interactions between people, and it is a market. So to say we're going to get away from markets is just fanciful. The outsourcing. I'm doing an insourcing at the moment, an insourcing. We insource one contract. We're now going to have to let out 120 contracts. That's what's actually happening, really. Okay. So, okay.
Or ask a question. Right, okay. And here, and then back to the platform. And then
hello, I'm Linda. I know nothing about economics. Right. I'm just a teacher.
Neither do any of us. It's not
<yet. laughs> no comment. But I just wonder if we could have almost a 1948 moment, probably deeply controversial, but I know that people in the country are deeply unhappy, there's a huge divide, so, well, you know, what harm would there be to renationalise things as a social consensus, but have real experts running them instead of these fly-by-night ministers who come and go, don't know anything, because one minute they're transport, the next there's something else. So, you know, a real social consensus. Do it properly this time, but almost a 1948 moment. That's what I've got to say.
Okay. Who'd like to come back from the panel? Hillary, if you want to go first.
I never thought I'd be defending Liz Truss here, but I think I might have just have a little moment, because I do think the problem that she faced was a very quick rise in interest rates. Actually, bond yields are no higher than they were when she bowed out. So, you know, I don't think they were necessarily caused by her. I would actually say that the interesting thing is that it all happened just as the Bank of England had announced its QT policy. So it was just about to start flooding the market with bonds it no longer wanted anymore, which would drive down the price of bonds, drive up the yield in bonds. And I do think the Liz Truss thing was just a catalyst rather than a cause, really. Which kind of is part of this issue about, you know, who do you want to control interest rates? Do you want it to be Bank of England, or do you want it to be politicians? And I think, you know, how politicians might do it badly, but we can get rid of them. And you know, Mark Carney did it badly, but we couldn't get rid of him. You know, in fact, you know, he's just... He's gone on to make things worse in lots of other places. On this question of inflation, so I think some things that you were saying about the Bank of England, the good job it had done, it all rests on the idea that inflation's a bad thing. Now, again, this might be unpopular for me to say, but I'm not sure inflation is such a bad thing. I think, you know, bouts of inflation from time to time are quite good at redistributing assets in society when they get a bit too sticky. The real problem, I would say, at the moment is the fact that the inability of workers to defend their living standards by fighting for higher pay to match the rise of the inflationary increases, that's the problem. It's not inflation itself. When we had inflation in the 1970s, massive hikes in inflation, massive hikes in pay, and actually workers came out broadly on top of that. So inflation isn't bad for workers in and of itself. It's bad in the kind of society we've got now where workers are not able to defend their living standards.
I've got to say, Hilary, I completely disagree with you on both points. Look, firstly, Liz Truss, to say...
At a certain age.
Look, yeah, sorry, I'm about to start mansplaining. Look, the point is this. I speak to infrastructure investors every single day of the week, apart from the weekends. Even then, they sometimes call me. There's one in the room at the moment. And they told me at that particular time that they were risk off the UK. In fact, some are. Some still are. Because they don't have any confidence in the ability of the UK government to actually have a long-term strategic plan of any kind whatsoever. And indeed, to not change its third prime minister. Well, we're on our third prime minister. Might be on a fourth one. I don't know. It's difficult to keep up. It's very hard for business to actually operate and to plan in that environment. So you have to have, the first thing you have to have as a government is stability, for heaven's sake. The second thing you have to do is have a credible plan. You can't go around slashing in the middle of a situation where you've got a massive debt pile on the back of the one in 100-year event. You've got to be credible here. Now, in terms of inflation being a good thing, Hilary, I don't know. Maybe I've lost the whole economics 101 thing here. If you're engaging in an inflationary wage price spiral, why is that good when it leads to no increase in productivity whatsoever? Now, if you want to talk about removing independence of the Bank of England, fine. I mean, ultimately, if the governor's a dud, the chancellor can get rid of the governor. It's not like the governor has to stay there in perpetuity. They think they're doing a bad job, get rid of them. But I can tell you, every time previously when we had reduction in interest rates before elections by government, they weren't acting in a expediency of the country economically, they're acting in politically expedient manners. So I think you can say a lot of things about the Bank of England, and you can criticise it. Some people actually say it doesn't have enough power because it doesn't look at unemployment rates. It should, in fact, its mandate should be increased, not decreased. It's another argument. But I think I'd be very careful at this point about throwing the baby out with the bathwater, and I do not think in any way inflation's a good thing, which is exactly why you have a situation where you've got strike action all over the place. When inflation's running at 2% and there's inequality, people hold their nose and say, OK, I'm comfortable with billionaires. At the moment, people are up in arms about it. It's, to quote Tracy Chapman from her 1980s song, talking about a revolution. We're living through a revolution now because people are not happy when inflation's at 10% or going down 6.7%, but it's still painful out there.
OK, I'll use a chair's prerogative. No more Liz Truss, please. We've only got 20 minutes left. She's had a good airing tonight.
Shall I come back on a few of the points that were made? Yes. First of all, I think there was this interesting point about, is this a pragmatic debate? I think there are pragmatic elements to it, and there are also moral elements to it. So to split those up quickly, and there are some fundamental moral questions about how much money do you think people should be entitled to spend of their own, and how much should be spent collectively, where should that kind of spending power, like control of resources in society, lay? You know, your view might be that we want to make more collective decisions, or that people should be able to keep a little bit of their own money. There's also questions then about kind of regulatory power, about the extent to which you want the state interfering in different ways in different places, that I think can be just as moral as pragmatic. I think on some of the other points, though, I kind of agree with you, is something about like outsourcing. I think outsourcing is a pretty pragmatic decision. Do you think you're going to get better value by the state doing this? Once you have decided that he's going to do that function, let's say we want to deliver prisons, I think it's a pretty pragmatic question about whether or not we think that should be done by a private company or whether that should be done by the state. It's kind of almost like an irrelevancy. One is might be lead to corporatist outcomes and propping up zombie companies and therefore have negative consequences. One might be just very inefficient. Maybe the state's not very good at delivering IT systems, for example, and therefore, although they're not very good at procuring those either, but you know, whatever. I think those things can be relatively pragmatic. I think this that kind of though brings me to where there is this question about, well, let's let's just like renationalize all these industries and everything will be great. We just need to put the experts in charge, which I think was kind of your question there. It's like, what experts, what people, like where they're coming from? Do you not think there's already experts in charge of the water industry? It's just, and that it's also very heavily regulated, and that the extent of investment they make in the system is determined by a formula of the state, and same with the prices they're allowed to charge. So it's like this, it is kind of privatized, but it's very heavily regulated and increasingly regulated by the state and told how to operate. I mean, it's not like nationalizing that, which would cost a huge amount of money, would fix that issue, because what it really needs is investment anyway, and where you're going to get the investment from. When it was state-owned, there was massive amounts of underinvestment in all these state-owned industries, and that's why they were of an even lower quality than they are today. So, no, I don't think there's that's probably a practical question, but I think it's also, you know, a kind of control question. I thought that comment about Germany was absolutely excellent, and I think it is precisely what happens when the state does get more involved in the economy. You get this kind of corporatist model where it is effectively a conspiracy of big government and big business. And we saw this time and time again in the German model, which was often has been talked up in the UK up until the last 6 months, so why can't we be more like Germany? Well, Germany had Wirecard, which is one of the biggest scandals that the German regulators tried to cover up. And they tried to stop the FT from reporting on this massive fraud going on, because they thought that these terrible Anglo-Saxon short sellers were making things up about Wirecard. No, Wirecard was a massive fraud that the German regulator covered up and tried to sue the FT. That's the kind of thing that happens when you have this kind of corporatist relationship. It's the same. It's a similar story with Volkswagen getting away with quite a lot, to the extent to which we talk about workers on boards. It's like, well, the worker representatives on boards were being taken on trips where they got to see some prostitutes along the way. I mean, these systems were heavily corrupt, and the whole model that Germany's built up isn't really working. Admittedly, there is both state and corporate failure there, but it seems like that isn't necessarily a model we want to go down. So I think that's a very good case to bring up. I might leave it there, have thoughts about lots of other things there.
Thank you. I'll try and be brief. I want to come back on the point that Matthew just made, actually, in respect to the question that was asked about, you know, is there a moral question about where the state should intervene, where it shouldn't? Is it just pragmatic? Because I think, actually, the example you used is one that does not actually suit your argument in many respects, the one of prisons. To me, that goes to the heart of the question. I think that when you're talking about the meting out of justice, incarcerating people because they've broken the law, they've broken the legal code, the moral code, whatever, then that seems to me fundamentally to be a job for the state, rather than Serco or some private company says, we're going to do that, we're going to deliver that justice by putting you in our prison because we can make a fast buck out of it. Seems to me to be a clear example of where the state should be responsible rather than where a private company should be responsible. I want to come back also on the, and I don't necessarily want to get bogged down on the Bank of England thing, but in many respects it does go to the heart of what we're discussing about the role that the state should play and elected governments should play. I think the danger in some of the arguments we always hear, which we've heard here about politicians, you know, they would be no better at setting interest rates, or they'll do it with an economic prejudice, or they'll do it because they want to play to the electorate at a particular time. I think the danger with that argument, where does that argument end? Where does that argument end? If you say, actually, let's take monetary policy away from elected representatives because these people will do it better, these unaccountable officials will do it better, and they won't be guided by bias, and they won't be guided by trying to appeal to the electorate, then why not do the same for fiscal policy? Why not say, well, fiscal policy should be done by technocrats as well as monetary policy? Why not get the OBR to write your annual budget and just get the Chancellor to read it out in Parliament? I mean, where does that argument end? For me, a fundamental plank of economic policy, which is control of the money supply, should be undertaken by elected representatives. As Hillary said, if they do it wrong, you kick them out at election time. And just very briefly, someone, I just wanted to pick up on it, someone said, you know, why do we have a sluggish economy? I think one of the reasons, we've talked about infrastructure, we're rubbish infrastructure. And I think also we've neglected the real economy, the productive sector of the economy, where wealth is created and where goods are made. We seem to have invested over recent years everything in financial services. And I think the real economy has become very much an afterthought. And I think the consequence of that is we've seen things like the emergence of the gig economy and zero-hours contracts, where, you know, the real economy, where we had an industrial base and a manufacturing base which supplied those good, solid blue-collar jobs in industries, thousands of them up and down the country, have now effectively disappeared. And the social consequences, not just the economic consequences of that, in terms of, you know, a lack of investment and productivity and so on, but the social consequences of that can't be understated either.
Thank you. Okay, so it's the final round of comments from the floor, and then just remind our panelists that they've got about 90 seconds each at the end to give us one point to go away on. I just want to re-raise one question very quickly that came up earlier in the discussion, which was about Biden's Inflation Reduction Act, and is there not a role for the state to be picking winners and focusing on areas of new development and so on, and what are the pros and cons? Perhaps people think about that. Obviously, you can comment on everything else, but that's one question that's been buzzing through the day. Okay, the last round. So, on your left.
Hi. I think there's lots of confusions going on here about like the state versus the private sector, for example. I mean, for me, if you're going to talk about the private sector, it means nothing unless there's competition. And the problem was with the water companies' privatisation and most of the rail privatisation and so on, there was no competition. So there was no incentive to drive forward, really, the sort of like improvement in services and things. And there are certain things that are sort of natural-ish monopolies, like prisons, for example. I mean, I don't want prisoners, like, after they've been sentenced, going, flicking through a brochure, going, well, I like the three-star Wandsworth, but, you know, whatever, you know, that's not going to work. So, you know, there's some... Whereas there are other sectors which I think could be very open to competition, like healthcare, for example. So we have healthcare competition in certain sectors like specs. Like, you know, we can go down the high street and go to different places. And I've had the fairly recent experience of needing a hearing test. And I waited 6 months for the National Health Service to get round to do it, and I got it the following week in Specsavers. So the ability of to do those things where there is the potential for competition could be very, very, very useful. And fake marketisation, i.e. simply privatising a monopoly, is not very useful. On the other question, which is about this other thing about, oh, is the state the best thing to run it or not? Take I live in Scotland, and the water is run by the state there. I mean, it's a state-owned company. And they've solved the problem of dealing with water pollution by just not measuring it. So in England and Wales, it's somewhere like 90-odd% of places have water monitoring, and in Scotland, I think it's 3%. So they have a much cleaner track record, and they're state-owned. So, you know, we have to compare, the point, very quickly, on long-term thinking, I think... We do need certainty, and people are going to invest. They want certainty about certain kinds of things. But what if those policies are bad policies? For example, where everybody freaked out when Rishi Sunak pushed the various bans back from 2030 to 2035, which was sensible in my view, but because it was now no longer long-term thinking and everybody was planning for 2030, then various market people freaked out. Long-term thinking about HS2, but if the train line from Birmingham to Manchester suddenly costs £36 billion, I think there is a case for cancelling it. So it's about long-term thinking. It's a question, really, a question of long-term thinking versus democratic control and being able to kick people out and change the policy. How does that work?
Great. Next, do you want someone to speak? Yep, no, behind you.
Yeah, I'm not an economist either.
Five in, so quick.
Yeah, I'm not an economist either, but every time I listen to an economist talk about what's the problem, what is the problem in the economy, and which is the way forward, they sound really convincing, and then the next person will come on and say, that's total rubbish. I think this is the problem, and that's the way to go. And the third one will come and say, well, actually, no, that is complete crap. It's that way and that way. And you think, hang on, capitalism is going for, I don't know, 200, 150, 200 years. surely you guys must have got some idea how the bloody thing works. You know, you got, you know, I had a dinner with my son and four of his economics graduates who had all first-class honors degrees. Two of them working in government as economists, and two are working in the private sector in some economist think tank. And we were sitting talking about, okay, so what do you think is the current cause of the current problem? Then got a bloody clue. You know, I said, okay, which is the way forward? They could not agree amongst themselves. I said, okay, if you guys don't know, surely your lecturers will know. What did they say? Because they're supposed to tell you about the rules of the game. I haven't got a clue. So people don't know what the game is. They don't know the rules of the game. Everybody's got an idea about which way to go, which way not to go. And everybody's, you know, like this room, all of us feel like, you know, we know the answer. We know what the problem is. I mean, it reminds me about...
Thank you. Okay. Very well made, yeah. It's called debate. In front...
Matthew made a point about contracting out being just a pragmatic thing. I think sometimes it is, like in social care, local authorities contract out care home provision to private care homes. They also contract out to private providers of care in people's homes. You can argue that perhaps they shouldn't, but there's an argument to be had there. In other areas, I think it's not pragmatic. I think sometimes it's actually driven by, like somebody mentioned expertise being lost in the state, but also there's a kind of a lack of confidence in state organisations. They tend to contract out when they've got a problem, if there's some sort of a crisis, they'll get the auditors in, they'll get consultants in, even kind of, you know, almost core business to this organisations. They seem to have lost expertise, and they'll look outside for advice before they look internally. I think it's not just a practical thing. I think sometimes it is driven by a real loss of expertise, confidence, and a real sense of loss of legitimacy as well.
Okay. There was one here. Yes, if you take it, and then to the back. Yeah. No. You, please.
Just two things I wanted to say quickly. One, I think there's a bit of a confusion between privatization and outsourcing, which are very, very different things. Privatization is giving part of what the government does, usually a monopoly to somebody in perpetuity. Outsourcing is a competition. I've been working for the public sector for 20 years in this business, so I know it quite well. And I think in terms of outsourcing and why it's done, whenever it's good or bad, yes, there's some horrible contracts, and that's what you hear of. There's a huge number of good contracts you don't hear of, and that's why you don't hear about them, because things are actually working, and they're working if they're managed well. One of the main reasons why outsourcing is happening is simply because if things are not outsourced in many areas, like prisons, the moment austerity hits, the first people who are getting fired are prison officers, and the first buildings being closed are prisons. If you have a contract, it stays in place. If it's not, it disappears, and you have a crisis, what you have now. So it's just something that works for people to understand when outsourcing works. In terms of privatization, I'll be very quick about this. I think that lady said in the front about why not run it by experts is an excellent point, and I think it does need to be considered. The issue is not with experts in privatized organizations. The issue is that the profit is driving privatized organizations. So why this profit is not made by government, which has 100% debt on their GDP, and why government is so scared or saying we should make profit in industries where there is no competition and we possibly can run it better and maybe have lower taxes, as the gentleman there says.
Thank you. Okay, I've got three more I'm going to try and take, so very quick, please.
In the 90s, I worked for the local council, and I remember when they outsourced. I was working, and then I started to work for the outsourcer, and went down into was the fact is that the same job was being done for twice the price. The council was being charged twice the price. I worked for them as a consultant. I came back for £350 a day to tell these people what they knew already. And what it showed was is that, and this was happening in the 90s, was the fact they didn't trust their own workforce. And I think this has been an infection that's gone through British society for such a long time. The fact, when in the 70s, you know, people go back to the 70s, why they liked the 70s is there was a structure. And people were very, very happy with the main industries like energy, the prisons, National Health Service, education, transport, all being handled by the state. And now we go forward 50 years, and the transport is mainly subsidized by us, so we might as well run it anyway. The energy is cartels. We know this. I don't have any choice, you know, and the prisons, you know, as Paul said, why would you give the prison service, the punishment organ of the state to private industry? And just to tell you what happened to all these councils is they gave it to there was this plague of privatization. They gave it to these outsourcers when they couldn't make any money 5 years later. And I worked for many of these people, Capita, all of them. They just handed it back to the council, and the council had to re-employ people again and lost millions of pounds that got stuck onto the council tax. And we do need to go back to a model that was working sometime in the 70s, I'm afraid.
Point made. Thank you. Two more right at the back, and then this gentleman here. Yeah, that'll be the last two. Sorry. Quick. Thank you. Half a minute.
I think included in Hillary's list of an area where government is involved but shouldn't be was environmental impact. And I wondered how you would propose to deal with, say, the decimation of our bee population resulting from pesticides that have... that the UK have chosen not to regulate, or the high levels of pollution entering our rivers from privatised water companies. And without regulation, how can competition deliver the protection that our rivers need from pollution?
OK, thank you. And finally there, and then I'll take you, Hillary, at the first.
Yes.
Go reverse order.
I'll be very, very quick. So I think it's the banks, actually, that have this policy of sacking the 5% least productive employees every year. Looking at productivity throughout the economy and all these zombie companies that are simply just dragging along, maybe what we need, and it's slightly contentious, is a recession.
Nice point to end on. Hillary, we'll do
great.
It in reverse order, so 90 seconds.
Bring it on, recession. I can't not say that the evidence for a wage price spiral is very weak, and actually most of the evidence at the moment does indicate that it's price gouging that's leading to inflation and not wage rises. There's two things I wanted to comment on. One is this competence of the state thing and the kind of consultancy fetish that people have raised and the inability of the state to really do anything. And I think I would just be really clear that I don't blame that on individual civil servants. I think there's a lot of individual civil servants really trying to do a hard job. And not being helped by the way in which the civil service works. But I think part of the problem is that if you get to situations where, you know, particularly when things are outsourced and people are cheaped from one employer to another, no idea who their employer is it any wonder that they're very cynical about the nature of their employment relationship? And that's one of the reasons why I think these are things that government should take responsibility for. And I think that there's only a point to the civil service if there's a point to government. And if a government doesn't have an aim and a vision and a strategy, then of course none of its employees will have that either. And that's why we need to change our politicians and force them to be more to be braver. I think...
Thank you. Ali?
Yeah, I mean... Just on politicians being braver, look, you go to Singapore. I mean, it's just totally pragmatic. It's very technocratic. They get the right people around the table. They get business around the table. They get the ministers. They get other parties in. You need to get on with it. They have a view of what's going to be needed in the next 20 years. No pussyfooting around. No short-termism that we have here. It's never going to happen here, in my view, because we have a complete, as Martin Wolf put in his latest book, the crisis of democratic capitalism is here and real, and people are losing faith in it. Now, on privatization... the reason why things are privatised, let's not just be misty-eyed about all this. I mean, look, Paul might want to go back to having soggy sandwiches on British Rail. I do not want to do that. On the water companies, I think that they have a lot to answer for, quite honestly, and there is an increasing mood to nationalise. But when you have a monopolistic system like the water companies, it's not about competition. They are monopolies. It's about regulation. The regulators also have to bear some responsibility for the mess that we're in. If you've got a privatized water system, you then regulate properly, right? And you hold these people to account. They don't take massive bonuses if they're not delivering the investment. But ultimately, my biggest challenge is to all of us in the room, which is this.
The public has to realise that there are trade-offs in this. You can't blame the politicians. There are trade-offs in spending for current consumption versus future consumption. There are trade-offs in the disruption caused by major infrastructure projects, which are good for the long term, like HS2. And there's also a trade-off between the political independence of things like Brexit. I don't want to get involved in that debate here. And your view on whether that's a good or bad thing for growth.
Thank you. Wow, we almost got to the end without actually talking about Brexit. Congratulations, everyone.
To chuck it in there.
No, I just obviously need to be very brief here. I think this thing about privatization and as outsourcing has taken an oversized role here. I agree it is ultimately about competition. Let's look at a successful case of privatization is probably British Airways. Not that British Airways is good, but the fact that we have competition that challenges British Airways and we don't have a nationalized monopoly that's been given too much power and we have a relatively open skies agreement have massively pushed down the cost of air travel. And I don't think we want to go back to a world where air travel is unaffordable and controlled by a small number of nationalised industries. But this really does actually go to my broader point here, which is we haven't actually spent that much time talking about how to revive economies. And I don't think nationalising water, which would cost a huge amount, or energy, which would also cost a huge amount, will do much to revive our economies. It would be a complete distraction from the things that we actually need to do. And things we need to do are fix up pretty much, you know, number one, and I mentioned at the start, but hasn't come up again, which is fix up the broken planning systems to actually build things. If you can actually build things, then you can have an entrepreneurial, well-functioning economy and take away the barriers to people being able to prosper. That is how you can revive the economy. It's not about state action as much as it's about getting rid of the barriers to people being entrepreneurial and people creating and doing things.
Paul.
30 seconds. I'm an old Labour romantic, I'm afraid, and we went through the 1930s. There was a depression. There was huge deprivation and suffering. We had hunger marches, national unemployed workers movements, and everything that went with it. And we had a very limited role for the state in that decade. We had laissez-faire economics, politics, and people came together after the war. And they said, never again, we're not going to go back to those days. We actually want a joined-up, coordinated society with a government that actually does things for us. We want a national health service. We want a welfare state. We want to have decent council homes. And the Attlee government built thousands, hundreds of thousands of them, so people didn't have to live in substandard, insanitary conditions. And in my view, they were absolutely right to do that. And in my view, that was an example of where the state can play a very positive role in people's lives and deliver good, decent outcomes for people to better their economic well-being and to better their social well-being as well. The state does some things wrong, but God forbid there comes a time when we say it should have no role in the economy at all, because I think we'll all be worse off for that.
We thank all our panellists, please.